A long time ago, in a street called Liverpool Street, a small road that was made of dirt and gravel that's no longer there, in a most downtrodden part of colonial Australia's wealthy city, Melbourne, a boy and a girl were born just a few doors apart, brought into life on the cusp of the 1890s depression in a disease-ridden slum. The boy and the girl grew into strong and determined children. Together they explored the fields of inner-city Melbourne, which rolled down to its majestic, murky river. They played cricket, and they even kicked a paper football, and they dreamed. As kids, Doc and Louis were never far apart, but their bond was always, supposedly, more than just the ordinary kinship that grows between children who live cheek to cheek in a close community, where front doors are always open and neighbours are as good as family. They had a kind of childish love for each other from the start. Perhaps they were even made for each other, destined. Or so it was said, at least so it was said to be said. Those are the first few words, the first chapter of a book that I came across recently and is going to form the basis of this week's podcast. And it's a book called Collingwood, A Love Story, by an Australian author called Paul Daly. And Collingwood is now a wealthy suburb, just about a mile northeast of Melbourne's central business district. It's no longer a slum now, it's a wealthy part of a wealthy city. People flock there at weekends to enjoy all the hospitality that Collingwood has to offer. The High Street in 2021 was voted by the Time Out magazine as the coolest street in the world. There's a great selection of bakeries, record stores, coffee shops and boutiques. If you go down the side streets, you'll find microbreweries, coffee roasters and restaurants, all hidden away behind roll-top doors. There's fascinating architecture and street art, and it's a place that you could easily spend a day wandering around in the Melbourne sunshine and forget what it was like prior to World War One. And it was out of this slum, I suppose, that Collingwood Football Club, Aussie Rules Football Club, was born in the late 1880s. The local people, the residents, community, business leaders and politicians all wanted to have a football club that would bring a measure of pride and hope to this downtrodden suburb. And so it proved, and Collingwood is now one of the most successful teams in what is called the AFL. They joined the AFL in 1897 and they play all their home games at the famous MCG, the Melbourne Cricket Ground. They won their first premiership in 1896 and since then have added 15 more titles and are currently the champions, having won the premiership last year, 2023. In 1958, they completely packed out the MCG when they played local rivals Melbourne, when 99,256 people turned up to watch that match. They really are one of the most famous teams in Australia. And the two guys that we're going to talk about this week both played a major part in those early days of Collingwood Football Club and went on to the Western Front. One of them wasn't to return. Now, every year, Collingwood will play Essendon in the AFL's annual Anzac Day match, and the Collingwood president, Eddie Maguire, carries an old horseshoe into the home team's changing room and he passes it around the players. The players examine it because there's a great story behind it. Doc Seddon, that we mentioned earlier, is a Collingwood player, and he introduced his childhood sweetheart, Louis, to his dashing teammate, a man called Paddy Rowan. Paddy sweeps Louis off her feet and they get married. But then war comes along. Doc and Paddy go off to fight, leaving Louis to raise Paddy's baby. But then, as we'll see in this podcast, Paddy's killed, and Doc promises that he'll always look after Paddy's wife and child. And just before the 1917 Grand Final, he sends a horseshoe back from the Somme, and he continued to serve there. It brings the Magpies, as the Collingwood team are known, luck, because they win. And that horseshoe still remains an important part of Collingwood's history. And it's those two lads that we're going to follow this week. Although he was known as Paddy Rowan, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission remembers Paddy as Percy Rowe. and we follow his last few days and hours as I walk the battlefields with two Collingwood season ticket holders who appeared on my podcast before, Michael and Susan Wyatt, who live in Melbourne, and they attend almost every Collingwood game with their son Tom, who's also equally passionate about this tremendously successful football team. So let's now go over to the Somme, where I recorded the podcast as we followed in the footsteps of these two lads, and we'll see what happened on the battlefield and also what the legacy was and the ripple effect that still affects families to this very day. So it's a beautiful spring Saturday morning. The weather yesterday wasn't very good. It was windy and bleak, and we had thunderstorms last night. But today, it's a beautiful day. There's even a bit of warmth in the sun, and I'm standing on the Somme near a village called Goudicourt, and on the location of what was called Needle Trench, just to the southeast of the village of Goudicourt. And I've come here today because we're following in the footsteps of two Australian lads from the Australian rules football team called Collingwood. And they were great mates who shared their lives in so many different ways, right from childhood, right the way through. One of them died here on the Somme and the other one lived to old age. But their lives are entwined, as we're going to find out during the course of this podcast. And I'm here with Michael and Susan, who are great fans of the Collingwood football team. So we better start off by explaining exactly then who this Collingwood team are. Are they as good as Arsenal?
Yes, the answer is yes. Arsenal are pretty good, but Collingwood are very good. So Collingwood Football Club is a member of the, and plays in the Australian Football League in Australia. Collingwood is a inner city suburb of Melbourne and has been part of that competition for well over 100 years now. Collingwood is the largest football club in the entire country of Australia, biggest club in the Australian Football League.
So in terms of supporters, then?
Supporter base, average attendances, membership base, all of those sorts of things. Now, some may argue a little bit with that, but I think
you're going to cause controversy when this podcast goes out across Australia.
Yes, simply because if you don't love Collingwood, you hate them.
Yeah, that's Marmite.
That's the
way they play at the MCG.
I think last year the average attendance was over 70,000 people. So it's a big deal. Australian Football League is the largest professional sporting competition in Australia as well. So this is big business.
It is big. And it was then before the First World War.
It was indeed, and it was the sort of thing in those days that if you lived in the suburb of Collingwood, for example, one of the things that gave you something to look forward to, because Collingwood was a difficult place. It was a slum area. It was a lot of poverty. So one of the things that gave them some joy was to be able to follow their football team. So it was a big deal in those days as well. Yeah. Significant rivalries with other clubs in the competition that continue right through to this day.
Yeah, a bit like soccer at home in England.
So
we've got the two lads that we're following today are Percy Rowe and his good mate Malcolm Seddon. They played together at Collingwood from about 1911 until they enlisted in the AIF in July of 1915. But they continued playing Aussie rules until they embarked in overseas in November of 1915. And they were great mates, enlisted together. They were posted to the 29th Battalion of the AIF. And prior to embarkation, Seddon was transferred to the 5th Field Company Engineers and then the 12th Field Company Engineers. Now, why are we? When it comes to Malcolm, we're not going to call him Malcolm, are we? We're going to call him Doc. Why is that?
Yes, we're going to call him Doc, and he was known as Doc all his life, and that was because when he was a young boy, he found an injured bird in the street or the backyard of his home, and tended to it and restored it to health, and his dad nicknamed him Doc, as in doctor, and that just stuck, and right to the very end of his life, everybody knew him as Doc.
Okay, so we're going to call him Doc from now on. not Malcolm. So without being sure that Doc applied for a transfer without telling Percy, that's effectively what happened. And maybe that's because Percy had married Doc's childhood sweetheart, his best friend. She was called Louisa, but she was known as Louie, so we're going to call her Louie. And his wife was pregnant with a son. Doc always said he was fine with them getting married, but the Seddon family probably think he wasn't quite telling the truth there. Now, Percy, he saw action in that awful battle at Tramiel on the 19th of July, 1916, that we talked about a few weeks ago. And he was slightly wounded in that battle. But Percy was to fall in action on the 3rd of December 1916, isn't it? 3rd of December 1916. And the reason that we've come to Needle Trench on this beautiful location it is today is that this is where they set off from that day. This was their jumping off position. And it wasn't really a jumping off position because they weren't actually going into battle that day, were they? They were just going up to the line to hold the line on the Trasloy Ridges, which is about 2 miles away from where we're standing. So we wanted to follow in his footsteps here today and tell his story. Now, Doc Seddon, he survived the war and he returned home to fulfil the promise that he'd made to Percy when they met up just a few days before Percy was killed. And Doc had promised to look after, in the event of his death, Louis and their little boy, who was also called Percy. Doc married Louis and Percy then had a stepdad to replace the dad that he'd lost. And Percy Jr. he played for the Collingwood as well, didn't he?
Yep.
Now, there's another aspect to this story, which I say we're going to cover today. Doc sent to the club in 1917 a horseshoe that he'd found on the Western Front as a good luck charm for the club during the finals that year. And it must have worked because they won the premiership
year
then, didn't they?
Yes.
And this horseshoe is still... it's still in the club's archives,
it
I believe.
Is, and it's very much a treasured possession.
I bet it is. Now, Doc resumed after the war. He came back and resumed his career with Collingwood when he got home in 1919. And they won the premiership again. They beat Richmond that year to win it. And that was known as the Peace Premiership after the war, Now, Doc went on to hold the position of chairman of selectors at Collingwood for many years, including through the club's golden age, when between 1927 and 1930, they won the premiership 4 times. And that's still a record. And he was obviously a very talented man. He went on to have a career in politics
as well.
He did,
yes, including he was mayor of the Collingwood area as well.
Right. Okay. Now, it wasn't until recently that you found out about this story, I understand.
No. I was... knowing that we were coming back to visit this area with
you.
This
is your third visit to the Western Front in the last few years,
it is, it is, yeah. So because we were coming back, my son, actually, our son, suggested why don't we find a Collingwood story. He is also a big Collingwood fan.
That's Tom,
That's Tom. That's our family tradition.
Yeah.
So I did, and stumbled across this story that I'd never heard of, and it was just fascinating.
And here we are.
And here we are.
On that position where they started from. So to set the scene, as I say, they weren't moving into battle. This is the end of November. The Battle of the Somme has officially come to an end. But of course, when a battle comes to an end, the suffering doesn't end. The killing goes on, the holding the line goes on, the shell fire goes on, trench raids continue, and people suffer and people die and people are wounded. And that's what happened on a very uneventful day. And in fact, when you look at the records, when you look at the dates of death, more people died in between the set-piece battles and what died in the battles. This is the horror, the true reality of the Great War and other wars as well. Now, there was a man in the 57th Battalion called Sergeant Walter Downing, and he wrote an account of what it was like to be here. And when we read his account, I'm going to ask you to read it, Michael. It's impossible today to imagine it. As I say, we've had heavy thunderstorms overnight, a lot of rain in the last few days. There's a lot of water lying around everywhere, a lot of mud. Some of the fields have got new crops in. Some are waiting to be sown with new crops. It's no wind at all. It's completely still. It is impossible when you read this account to imagine what it would be like. The only way you could possibly imagine it when we read it is to try and walk through some of these waterlogged fields, because the mud would just stick to you and we wouldn't be able to move very far. Well, we're not going to try and do that.
Right.
Would you like to read that account?
Yes.
And it goes down to there.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, Sergeant Walter Downing says, "We entered a waterlogged sap where one or two duck boards were uselessly floating. Then there were no more duck boards but mire, to the thighs at best, to the middle at worst. their men were caught as in a vice. There were wires in which one's equipment caught fast. They wound about the sights of one's rifles, pulling its strap from one shoulder so that it fell in the ooze which covered the gripping clay as one battled with one's legs. There were occasional bodies underneath, possibly of some lonely nightfarer who had been wounded and had struggled till he sank or, unconscious, was suffocated without a struggle, the manner of his end a secret of the bog. The effort of lifting one's rear leg clear, then pushing it forward, drove the other into deeper, more tenacious clay. All the time shells and rain fell from the leaden, pitiless skies. There was no avoiding the one or the other. What few dugouts there were full of water. We were buried to the waist in clay and slush, which increased as the drizzle came steadily down. The dead lay everywhere. The deeper one dug, the more bodies one exhumed, hands and faces protruding from the slimy, toppling walls of trenches.
It's unbelievable to read that now, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, at no stage has he talked about in that account actually fighting. He's just talking about moving around in this battle. And there must have been thousands of men here. And today we're stood here, and the only thing I can see is a bird in the sky, two birds in the sky, and the windmills just off the battlefield, silently turning, generating electricity. Just listen. Rumble of an aeroplane in the distance. Rooster. Yeah, so we've now got a letter that was sent to Percy from Louis. He called her Louis, his wife. And this is what she said, because back home, Percy Jr. had been born not long ago, and this is what she said in that letter to him.
Percy Jr. is crawling, and the other day nearly went clean off the front veranda. We sit out there at night, as it is shaping as an especially hot summer, and there is much to talk, etc., about bushfires already. Christmas, they say, will be scorching. We have to sit out the front every night so we get the breeze. Dad takes little Purse over to Gangham's Reserve in the pram most evenings after dinner. We find that he sleeps better that way. It must be quite the grandparent thing to do, as a number of seniors are often over there pushing prams. I expect it is quite cold over there, as the papers here say it is the nastiest European winter for many years.
And it was that winter. It turned out to be the coldest winter in something like 50 years, and this was just the beginning of the winter.
So you must stay warm, my darling, and take care of yourself for us. Have you seen Doc? I'm sure he knows, but please tell him that his father was very poorly, but has come good and is now doing well, or so his brother Donald says. Please send him my love and my very best. For now, my darling Percy, goodbye. All of our love from your loving wife, Louis, and your little boy, Percy.
That's amazing, isn't it, to read that? I mean, that's a sense of normality from home, isn't it, in amongst all this chaos. I said it was the 3rd of December. 3rd of December is when they moved up from here, and it was the 5th of December he was killed, wasn't it? Not the 3rd, they've moved up. And they've moved up from this position. You know, so we've got Walter Dowling describing exactly what the conditions were like, conditions out of hell, really. You couldn't make it up. Yeah. And then back home, you've got his wife sending, you know, a lovely letter to him, worried about him. You can see she's worried, but, you know, trying to explain to him that life at home, baby Louis, he's doing fine, and he's going to take his first steps, isn't he?
And Doc.
Mm.
Give my love to Doc.
To Doc as well, yeah, of course, yeah. Yes. Doc, who was to play a major part in her life as we go on. It's just unreal, isn't it? It's just surreal to be here.
Yeah, it is.
It's just nothing happening at all. Sometimes you hear tractors rumbling past, but there isn't any. It's Saturday morning, perhaps they're having a day off. It is. And this is where his journey began, that way. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to follow his journey and see what happened.
Good old Collingwood forever. They know how to play the game. Side by side they stick together. Uphold the magpie's name. See the barrackers are shouting, as all barrackers should. Oh, the premiership's a cakewalk for the good old Collingwood.
So we're now standing right on the edge of the Somme battlefields, where they dug in, both sides dug in to these dreadful conditions that we were reading just now. And we've driven 10 minutes probably, 5 to 10 minutes, 3 or 4 miles. And this is where, from Needle Trench, Percy and his comrades moved up to hold the line in the trenches on the 3rd of December 1916. And the plan was they were to hold the line for 2 days. We wouldn't want any longer than that here in these conditions. And they were to do some patrolling as well. And the German gunners were over the ridge that we can see in front of us. Now the battlefield here has changed since 1916. It's changed considerably, because just outside of the Somme battlefield we can see the windmills, dozens of them. And the big change that's happened is there's a high-speed railway, and there's the A1 motorway as well that goes all the way down to Paris. And we obviously use that motorway to get to the Somme ourselves. That bisects the battlefields, and now it's running right the way through no man's land, because we are standing on the spot of Spectrum Trench, and this is Zenith Trench, the junction of the two British trenches that were here, or what was left of the trenches. They were really just muddy holes that were linked up together. And if they were to attack the Germans or to go out patrolling, they would have to go down a shallow slope, and then they would have to go up quite a steep, small ridge. And then by this time in the Battle of the Somme, or what was left of the Battle of the Somme, the Germans had situated their front lines on reverse slopes, reverse ridges, on the other side of the ridge. And it meant that as the attackers or patrollers, had they come over the ridge in daylight, they would have been silhouetted against the skyline, and it would have been easier. And also, the German guns on the other side of the ridge were out of sight. Their positions were out of sight, and also their big guns were out of sight as well. They couldn't be spotted easily from the ground by the British. So it gave the Germans, it was a different tactic that they'd used by this stage, and it gave them another advantage. So the German gunners over the ridge knew the precise bearings of the channels that these British were going to have to use, because don't forget, not long before this was their ground, it was their trenches, so they knew everything about it. The shells were coming over all night, every few seconds, lighting up the sky as they whistled down onto their targets. And as we say that, a high-speed train whizzes past us, going from the coast down to Paris. So they come up here on the 3rd of December, and Percy is killed here by shell fire on the 5th of December. But, you know, there's some mystery behind that. The battalion diary tells us that nothing was going on that day. So remarkable was the incident that claimed his life. It doesn't even get a mention in the unit diary. It just says on the day in question, disposition unchanged, which means that nothing's happened. They haven't changed their positions. They haven't moved anywhere. Now, not far away, Doc was working with his unit, Switch Trench, which is about 4 or 5 miles away between Flern and Longueval, which means that by chance they weren't far away from each other when he was to die. And now we've got some eyewitness accounts of what happened to Percy. And in this account, he's referred to as Pat by his mate, isn't he? Yes. Which makes it more confusing. Would you like to read that then, Michael?
Yes, and I can explain why he was called Pat, which is confusing, because our man Percy also went by the name of Paddy Rowan.
Okay, what was that?
It's believed it was because, as well as being an Australian rules footballer of distinction, he was also a very good boxer.
Oh no, he's one of these annoying people who's good at everything.
He is, yeah. And in Collingwood and those sorts of suburbs of the inner city of Melbourne back before the war, boxing was, and I think it was the same in England, was a very common occurrence. People would go and watch a lot of fights.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you were good and you wanted to put a bet on yourself, and your name is Percy Rowe, the bookmakers say, well, I'm not taking that bet because you're too good. So what you do is you change your name.
Your name.
And you become Paddy Rowan.
So it's fraud.
It is. Now, what's interesting as well with this is Percy Rowe, as far as the Collingwood Football Club is concerned, you also have to very much look him up as Paddy Rowan. He played under that name at the club as well. Right. However, he was Percy Rowe. So that's why
he's referred to as Pat, in this letter that's been sent.
Yes.
By his mate. What does his mate say then about
he
what
He says,
happened?
Dear sir, I am enclosing details of how Pat Rowan, Collingwood's crack follower, got fatally wounded. I was with Pat and some more chaps in a bombing post in one of the hottest corners of the Somme firing line. It rained shells and bullets here. We had some very miraculous escapes, but fortunately no one was seriously hit till about half hour before we got relieved when Pat got hit. It was about 6 p.m. on the evening of Monday, December 4th. Pat was stooping down, doing up his equipment, getting ready to leave the line when a shrapnel shell burst on the parapet about 3 feet above our heads. Pat gripped his side and fell. Turning to us, he exclaimed, "I'm gone. Goodbye, lads. Shake hands." He held out his hand. I gripped it. He then turned over and rolled in pain. I immediately sent for stretcher bearers and with the aid of another lad undid Pat's clothes and dressed his wound, which was a jagged one about 3 inches long and the small of the back near the left kidney.
We saw a piece of shrapnel that was just like that where we were just now, not here, different location. So that's, as we know, that's what caused most of the casualties in the Great War, was these pieces of shrapnel.
Mm.
He goes on, doesn't he?
He does. He says he complained of a dull pain in the stomach and said he felt himself running in the stomach. I expect he had internal hemorrhage. The stretcher bearers took him to the dressing station, but I believe the doctor held out no hope from the first look. Pat died the same night and is buried near Trones Wood in a soldier's battlefield cemetery. Pat was our platoon sergeant, and the boys of 11th Platoon felt his death very keenly, as he was an honest, straightforward sort of good soldier and had the fullest confidence of his men. He was calm and collected right through and seemed to know as soon as he was hit that he was fatally wounded. I am writing you these details as I reckon it's my duty to do so for Pat's relatives and friends.
And it was just before Christmas, and back home in Australia, Percy Jr. had just started crawling. The news for Louis's wife was the worst possible. Percy, she was told at that time, was missing in action, believed dead. And he talks about him being buried near Trones Wood. He wasn't. He may well have been taken to Trones Wood for attention in an advanced dressing station. But as we'll find out later, he got back to a casualty clearing station where he died of wounds actually the next day. And she heard nothing definite for another month. She was living in hope, although it had been reported that he died in France, that perhaps he was still alive. And then on the 19th of February 1917, so quite a while later, a letter came, and it was in a plain envelope, and it was addressed to her. You going to read that letter for me?
Yes. It says, "Dear Madam, herewith please receive certificate of report of death of the late number 924 Sergeant P.E. Rowe, 29th Battalion." She opened the certificate. It was dated 22nd of January. "This is to certify that according to the records, number 924, Sergeant Percy Edward Rowe, 29th Battalion, Australian Imperial Force, is reported by cable message, died at 38th Casualty Clearing Station on 5th December 1916 of gunshot wound, abdomen."
A few months later, and the story's not over there, Louis receives a small package in the post, and it contained Percy's few belongings, 6 coins, a couple of notebooks and some photographs. And the pictures included the only one that survives of him and Louis, which was taken just after the wedding, and the one of Doc dressed in their best suits, him and Doc, taken before they joined up. And most sad of all, the package contained her dead husband's identity disc. Meanwhile, the war went on, and so did Doc, of course, without his mate. He travelled around France and Belgium, fortifying trenches, been in the Royal Engineers, building roads and dodging enemy shrapnel, gunfire, and by early 1917, the Germans were using poisonous gases. And during the last 2 years of World War One, Doc was frequently in the region of Hyley, where Percy was buried and where we're going to go next. We wonder whether he took time to go and see his mate's grave, to kneel at the cross that marked his final resting place and say farewell, because he was going to go back to Australia, of course. Any best mate would. But it would be 90 years before anyone related to Percy visited his grave. And it's his grave that we're going to go to next. We're going to follow his final journey from here. about 15 miles back behind, well behind the lines, and see. It's very emotional for you, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Gives me goosebumps just reading this. And yeah, it does. Very emotional. We don't, you know, he's not related to us at all, but there's a real connection.
There is, isn't there? With home, and you're a long way from home.
A long way from home, a connection for, and for me, this is my two great interests in life all combining together in an incredible story in an amazing way. Yeah, it's very emotional.
Let's go and see his final resting place, shall we?
Yeah.
So we've now come to Highley Station Cemetery, which was the location of a casualty clearing station to the southwest of Albert. And it's in the direction of Amiens. 36th Casualty Clearing Station were here from April 1916, just before the Battle of the Somme, and then other casualty clearing stations came here as well, and they were here until early June 1917. The cemetery itself, it was begun in May 1916 and used by the three medical units until April of 1917. And then between March and May of 1918, Australian units used it. The last burial here at Highley Station, very unusual cemetery, was in May of 1919, and there's nearly 3,000 Commonwealth servicemen of the First World War that are buried or commemorated here. Because this is a site of casualty clearing stations, only 12 of them are unidentified, because when they get here, they know who they are. And there's 21 special memorials that have been erected to casualties whose graves are here in the cemetery, but they're not sure exactly where. And there's also 83 German graves here, no doubt prisoners of war from the Battle of the Somme. Now, the reason why this cemetery is so unusual is because in August and September of 1916, the Battle of the Somme is raging and the casualties are very heavy. They're coming back to places like this by train. The railway line runs very close to the cemetery even today. And the burials in this cemetery were carried out under extreme pressure, and many of the graves are either too close together to be marked individually, or in many cases they contain multiple burials. They've actually buried them on top of each other. Some headstones carry as many as three sets of casualty details, and therefore there was not room on the headstones to put the regimental badges. They had to be omitted. So what they did, the architect had the fantastic idea. There's always a shelter in a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery. There's a rather large shelter here, and on the red brick wall where I'm sitting now are the regimental badges of 117 that have been carved on what is a cloister wall on the north side of the cemetery. And with these red bricks and the arches that I can see before me, it's no surprise that this cemetery was designed by Sir Edwin Lutyens. We see these arches in so much of his work, most famously, of course, on the Tietvale Memorial. But here he's built these arches, designed these arches at Highley Station Cemetery.
And I've even found evidence of Lutyens' obsession with red bricks and arches in the seaside Norfolk village of Overstrand, where I think it was about 1896, Lutyens designed a small chapel there. And when I walked past there, knowing that Lutyens had come, spent a lot of his time in Norfolk and Overstrand, I thought it looked familiar. And when I researched, lo and behold, he designed that as well. So these features that we associate with Edwin Lutyens, they were obviously part of his work long before he was employed by the Imperial War Graves Commission, as it was then, to design the memorials to the missing and some of the features of the cemeteries. Now, we said that this particular casualty clearing station, the 36th, as it was in the summer of 1916, was almost overrun with the amount of casualties that were coming back by train from the Battle of the Somme. And the 36th casualty clearing station kept a diary, as all units did. And it gives us an idea of the work undertaken here by the unit in the month of July, the first month that the Battle of the Somme was fought. And it lists the activities. It said, admitted officers, 79, 22 deaths. That's quite a high percentage, isn't it? But not when it comes to other ranks. There were 16,045 other ranks admitted, but only 401 of those died. Still a lot of deaths, but as a percentage, it's not that many. It means that over 15,500 of them managed to move on to the next stage in the evacuation process to a base hospital. There were 480 Germans admitted, 28 of those died, and incredibly they carried out 759 operations in the theatre, and no doubt a lot of those operations will involve amputations. 105 of those admitted had penetrating shell wounds. That sounds awful, doesn't it? So the soldier has been hit by a piece of shrapnel, probably, in the front line. They haven't been able to remove the shrapnel from the wound because they hadn't got the medical expertise closer up the line, maybe in an advanced dressing station. So they've kept the wound in place until it reaches Haley in a sophisticated casualty clearing station with trained doctors, practically out of the range of the German guns, but not completely. And they've been able to remove the shrapnel, clean up the wounds, and then hopefully save the casualty. And then there were 65 compound fracture of the legs and 167 penetrating abdominal wounds. But it says that nearly half of those, 46% of them, recovered, the soldiers recovered. The ones that were hopeless cases were taken to the theatre for palliative care. And it says the return of intestines, which is, again, absolutely horrific. So the soldier's dying, his intestines have been removed by the blast, and all they can do is give him morphine painkiller and put his intestines back in his body and await for him to die. And those soldiers that would have died are now buried in that cemetery. And we've got a report from one of the medical officers working with the Royal Army Medical Corps, Captain Geoffrey Keynes, and his account of what he experienced there is quoted in Lynn MacDonald, her book The Roses of No Man's Land, which I really do recommend. It's still easily available. And Geoffrey wrote these words. He says, "The hospital was too far from the front line to be any danger from enemy shells, but the sound of the guns was the incessant background of our lives, and we could often anticipate the arrival of casualties by noting the increased intensity of the bombardment. It sometimes reached a level that had to be heard to be believed. There were days of comparative inactivity, but at other times the surgical teams had to work for an indefinite stretch of time. We simply kept going as long as there were patients to attend to. I remember one period vividly where I worked continuously for 21 hours before I was able to collapse into my bed. After I'd been sleeping for only 3 hours, another convoy arrived and I was roused to go to the operating theatre. I operated continuously for another 21 hours. Then the same thing happened again. I was called up after only 3 hours sleep. But then I was so low physically that at first I literally could not stand up. It took me a good half hour before I could collect my faculties and begin my duties." Now, just reading the same book, there's an account by Captain Reverend Leonard Pearson, and like so many of these padres, he ended up helping in these casualty clearing stations. And in Leonard's case, he was involved as an anaesthetist. And this is how he describes one dreadful day working in one of these casualty clearing stations. He said, "Sometimes the operating theatre was going day and night. There was a sort of cup, a wire cup with gauze in it, and you had to hold it over the man's nose and mouth and drop the anaesthetic onto it very carefully, keeping a close eye on the patient. I remember one case. He was a man of a tremendous size, a colonel. They brought him in and laid him on the table, and the surgeon said, 'Get on with the anaesthetic.' But I couldn't get the man under. I did my best. I had two orderlies holding him down, but no, he wouldn't go under. I said to the surgeon, 'Well, what shall I do?' The surgeon was very busy operating. He didn't even look up, and he said, 'You must get him under.' Then, to my horror, the fellow ceased breathing. I thought I'd given him too much chloroform, and I was very worked up. I said, 'Now, surgeon, what about it? This chap stopped breathing. Can't you come and look at him?' The surgeon simply said, 'Well, pull him round. Pull him round. I can't leave this chap.' He was amputating a leg, and it was a question of tying off the arteries so the man wouldn't bleed to death. Very delicate work, which he couldn't leave. I tried every possible means to restore the patient, jerking his arms around, pressing his chest, and finally, just when I thought I'd have to give up, he took one gasp and he began to breathe. When the surgeon had finished with the other chap, he came over to my patient and started to take his arm off at the shoulder. But as soon as the operation began, he started to sink and he died on the table. I felt very badly about it, and later on, when we had a moment to spare and we were together in the mess, I said to the surgeon, "I'm terribly sorry about that man, dreadfully sorry. I felt it was my fault." But the surgeon said, "You mustn't say that. Nobody could have done better than you." I expected the man to die because his physique was not up to the life within it. It certainly wasn't your fault. He never chided me at all, and I went on to give anaesthetics because no one else could be spared to do it. As I'm reading that, what I'm thinking of is that man, Pearson, went over to the Western Front to offer prayers and comfort to the soldiers, and there he was, completely untrained, carrying out the role of a skilled anaesthetist. So these were the sort of conditions that Percy Rowe would have encountered, although he was probably unconscious, when he arrived at this casualty clearing station in December of 1916, and that's where he died the day after he'd been wounded 15 miles to the east on the Le Trensloy ridges. And we now return to the cemetery at Hyley Station to conclude the journey that we've been following in the footsteps of Percy Rowe.
And we've come here today with my Australian guests, Michael and Susan. Michael is holding his flag and his scarf from Collingwood Football Club, who he's not talking about today because they lost last night. And he's got his hat on as well. And we've come to pay our respects to Percy Rowe, who we've been following today in his footsteps. He'd have been brought here badly wounded on the evening of the 4th of December 1916, and it's here that his story ends the next day on the 5th, when he dies of his wounds. And we're now, Michael's going to take me to his grave. Michael's been here before. Lead the way then, Michael.
I haven't been here before.
Have you not been here before?
No.
Oh, I thought you had.
No. Well,
so he's buried then in plot 6, row D, grave 12. So Susan has been finding the graves for us on our visit to the Somme over the last few days, and she's going to lead the way because she seems to have an instinct in knowing where these guys are buried. Signs in this cemetery of the very wet winter that we've had in Northern Europe. The grass is quite long. There's some weeds that thrive in wet weather, and the commissioner, right in the middle of the cemetery, have had to remove some of the grass and replace it. That work is still ongoing, and typically it's in the very row where Percy is buried who we're looking for. So we're now not walking on turf, we're walking on earth, on mud, flattened mud. But here we find a headstone that has two names on it, as we were talking about just now. Private PT Plunkett of the 29th Battalion Australian Infantry, who's also died on the 5th of December 1916. So he's from the same unit as Percy, isn't he? And he's died on the same day. So it could well be that he was wounded by the same shell and that they've made that final journey together. And then there's a space, and then the Australian Imperial Force badge is on the top, crest is on the top. Then on the bottom it says 924 Sergeant P.E. Rowe. This is the man from Collingwood that we've come to see. So now you're going to place your flag and scarf. It's given you the shivers, isn't it?
Yes.
Having come from the other side of the world to see this hero of Collingwood. Michael places a small flag, black and white colours. That's the colours that Collingwood play then, is it? It's got a magpie on it, and then they wrap a scarf. Susan carefully wraps it across the top of the headstone. If Percy's looking down on us, he'll now see his grave with a flag, a black and white flag and the black and white scarf, dated 2023. Is that in celebration of the Premiership victory?
Well, as it turns out, we did receive that flag as one of our member rights and privileges and
right,
so forth.
Yeah.
It turns out that it was a Premiership year.
Premiership, so. Yeah. It's a very special moment, isn't it? What are your thoughts now then, Michael, as you stand here having come all the way from Melbourne, the other side of the world? What do you think when you stand there and see the grave of what would have been one of your heroes?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to put into words, to be honest. I mean, this is so special. I do feel a bit sad.
Mm. Especially knowing that he had that little boy, Percy Jr.
Yeah.
But at least we know that Percy went on to play for Collingwood as well, don't we? And that his mate looked after.
Yeah, and having read their story, I mean, these guys, I mean, we love our football club too, but having read their story, we know that they loved it as well.
They share that passion, and it could be any one of us beneath that headstone,
couldn't it?
In a different time, in different life, different circumstances. It's a beautiful spot here. There's just the odd daffodil now coming out in the spring. Winter flowers are slowly being replaced by the commission.
I also sort of think, you know, if this was one of our current footballers, you know, the outcry of just one.
The grief from the club.
And yet here we stand in a cemetery full of just
full of Australians. A lot of Australians here, aren't they?
Full of people from, you know, again it just magnifies the scope
horror
of what went on. We're just here thinking of one man, and as I say, I think, gosh, if that was one of our players today that was to go off to a conflict, just one, and would lose their life, it would be major news.
There's nearly 3,000 here.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like there's 3,000 here, because there's two or three to a headstone, but there are 3,000 here.
Well, this is a very special day.
About you, Susan?
It's hard to believe.
Because you go and watch them as well, don't you?
Every
the whole
week.
Family goes.
Every week.
Yeah.
We go with our son, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, it's definitely Michael's two greatest passions.
Come
joined
together
here at this exact moment,
football,
that's for
Aussie
sure.
Aussie Rules football and
Collingwood Footy Club.
Collingwood
yep.
football, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we've concluded his journey, haven't we?
Good on you, Percy.
Yeah.
Thank you
for your
you.
Sacrifice, Percy,
yeah.
and all the others that are here.
Yeah, yeah. And he'll be pleased to know that his team are the reigning champions, even if they did lose.
Even if they've lost, played two, lost two so far.
No, but we don't talk about that.
No. Thank you, Percy.
So that may be the end of Percy Rowe's story, but it's not the end of the story for Collingwood Football Club on the Somme. Because there's another one, another soldier who played for Collingwood that we found in Delville Wood Cemetery. That was a man called Tom Wright, Thomas James Wright. He played for Collingwood in the Victorian Football League. He played his first game in 1906 against Essendon. And a report of his first match said that Wright, a district junior, gave satisfactory promise of future usefulness. He played another three matches for Collingwood that season, including playing in their losing semi-final against Carlton. He played another eight senior games in the following year, 1907, and again they lost in the semi-final, this time against South Melbourne. And then he went off to New Zealand. He was appointed New Zealand's captain for the team, and they played in the Jubilee Australasian Football Carnival, and his adopted country, New Zealand, defeated both New South Wales and Queensland. But then, after his career, he returned to Collingwood and he served on their committee until he resigned upon his enlistment with the AIF for the First World War. He was transferred to the 59th Battalion of the AIF on the 4th of August 1916 and became a corporal in October 1916. But he was killed on the 12th of December 1916, again on the Le Transloy Ridges, just a week after Percy had died, and he was buried in Delville Wood Cemetery. So if you're on the Western Front, right next to Delville Wood itself is the enormous cemetery there, and if you go in there, you'll find Thomas. He was 34 years old when he died, and if you know Collingwood, he lived at 89 Islington Street. We visited Delville Wood and Tom's grave when we were there. I didn't tell Michael until we were there that I was looking for another Collingwood man, and it gave him another connection with his home city, with his favourite football team. And as we stood there looking at his grave in that beautiful cemetery, we wondered whether Tom and Percy knew each other, whether they'd played together and whether they'd fought together. We'll never know, of course. It's just a thought. So to tidy up the loose ends of this story, we need to find out what happened to Doc Seddon after the war. Well, he returned home in April of 1919, and of course he remembered that he made a promise to his mate Percy that he would look after Louis and young Percy, and he fully intended to do that, and it wasn't long after he returned and romance soon started to develop between Doc and Louis. He also became a successful businessman, became quite wealthy as well. And then he played for Collingwood for a few years after the war before he retired and then became chairman. On the 11th of October 1919, he played in the Collingwood team that beat Richmond by 25 points and 45,000 people inside the MCG to see that game. And as always, Louis was one of them. After his term as chairman finished, he was also a committee man for many years. And in 1923, so 5 years after the war had ended, Doc and Louis were finally married, and he'd kept that promise from the battlefield. And it was almost exactly 8 years after he'd been best man in the same church when Louis and Percy had been married. Young Percy, as quite often they did, then went to live with his grandparents, but he got on very well with Doc, who became his stepfather, and he called him Dad. The marriage then produced two other children, Shirley and Malcolm, and Doc continued to be successful in business. He was one of the first in the neighbourhood to own a car, and the kids were always well-dressed, and he wore fine clothes as well. He also went into politics, and he served as a Labour councillor for 22 years, and he also served on the boards of the local hospital, medical centres and several different community organisations. And he also became a Justice of the Peace. And then in 1941, during the war years, he became mayor. And it was in that same year that young Percy joined the army against the wishes of his parents. But he stayed at home. He joined the Australian Air Force and he never left Australia. And it was thought that Doc had pulled some strings to ensure that he wouldn't go abroad, again keeping that promise to Percy that he'd made all those years before. And then in August 1955, Doc died at the age of 67. He had a massive heart attack whilst he was chopping wood. And 2 years later, Louis died heartbroken. And the last action that she did in her life was to go and watch Collingwood play. So that's the story of those Australian lads. The story, as I say, has been told in detail in Steve Daly's book, A Collingwood Love Story. And it's just two soldiers, really. Remarkable men, as they all were. And it's stories like that that really gave me the idea of this podcast in the first place, Tales from the Battlefields, because their story hasn't been told to a wider audience. Maybe people from Collingwood have read the book and they know his story, but Michael said himself he didn't know it until quite recently. And hopefully through this podcast, it brings their story and other stories to life that we perhaps haven't heard before. That was the whole point in why I sit here rambling on. So we now leave the Somme, and a brief update on what's going on in Ypres at the Menin Gate. If you remember, it was a year ago now that the scaffolding was put in place at the Menin Gate and the 54,000 names hidden, whilst the gate began a restoration project. And the Commonwealth War Graves Commission have updated several videos onto YouTube and onto their own website to give us an idea of the project and the work that's ongoing. So what I want to do now is just give you a taste of a couple of those short videos by playing them, just obviously the audio only, and then there's some important news about what's coming up in the next couple of months.
My name is Sarah Kameling. I'm the project manager for the Menengate Restoration Project. We're standing here at the Ieper Menengate Memorial, and we're at the beginning of a big restoration project. We aim to start in 2023, and we plan to do restoration works for the coming 2 years to make sure that the memorial is again up to its full glory by its 100th anniversary in 2027. One of the basic elements in our approach is to conserve as much as possible in situ. That means when we see a damage, we try to solve it in situ with the same materials that are already in the building. This is a really sustainable and durable way to tackle a restoration project. Only when that is not possible, we go to the second step, and that is restoration. And we try to use as much as possible recuperation material for this. And as a last resort, we have new materials that come in, but those are really like for like. So we try to look for materials that are identical in color, in sizes, and in material, so they fit within existing building and its authentic use of materials. The Menengate Memorial is a memorial to the missing. So one of the key features of the memorial are the name panels. These are, of course, included in our restoration campaign. In the preparation phase, we processed all the name panels to see which damage occurs on which panel to make sure we have the correct intervention planned. The panels are in quite a good state. We will do a cleaning where necessary and also a re-engraving where the name is not legible anymore. Sometimes the panels show a little bit of damage to the natural stone. Also there, we will do small reparations such as a stone insert or a bigger new piece introduced in the name panel. So the memorial is built out of two major elements, namely brick masonry and natural stone. We see a complete diverse range of weathering to the natural stone, going from cracks to erosion to discolorization. Here you see how the metal damaged the natural stone. So the rust inside of this metal feature made not only the metal expand and giving cracks to the natural stone, but also it gave that green discolorization. So here we will dismantle the metal feature. We will treat it so it doesn't rust in the future anymore. And then we will tackle the natural stone by using a paste to distract the discolorization and also using a lime mortar to fill the cracks so it's closed again and preserved for the future. So one of the biggest tasks of the restoration campaign are the facades, which are built out of brick masonry and the joints. We will completely remove all the existing joints to make sure that the building is again closed. We will replace the existing pointing with the lime mortar. And on some places, we've seen that also the bricks were damaged. So we have been looking for a good replacement brick to do the restoration. So it's important that we go for a brick which has the same size and color, so they really fit within the existing facades. One of the major aspects in the restoration project is to tackle the waterproofing of the roofs. At the moment, the roofs are covered with a plastic membrane, which is at this stage not sufficient anymore to protect the building. We will remove all this material and we will replace it with a new waterproofing system. This was also for us an opportunity to think, how can we do something extra? And on top of the waterproofing system, we will introduce an eco roof. This will, in fact, protect the waterproofing. It will longer its lifespan, but it will also be a very big stimulant and big positive impact on the biodiversity of the surroundings. One of the tasks we will do during the restoration is the repainting of the ceilings. This is quite a complicated task, not only giving the profiling of the ceilings, but also because we found in one of the paint layers asbestos. We need to build a complete platform and scaffolding to be able to access the ceilings. That will, of course, have some impact on accessibility of the gate. After the removal of the existing paint layers, we will restore the structure where needed of the profiling, and then we will repaint the ceilings again.
Now, those videos were produced about a year ago, and a year is now up in the restoration project. There's still another year to go, but the commission has made quite a lot of progress, and it means that some of the Menin Gate will be open for us to access again. And between the 8th of April and the 8th of May, the scaffolding under the main hall that was talked about there will be removed, and they're going to close access through the gate to motorised traffic during this time. But there's pedestrian channels or tunnels that are there. They'll still be there, so we can still move from the town through the Menin Gate itself and out to the bridge on the other side. But then the exciting news is from the 9th of May 2024, the last post ceremony will return to its original location, and we'll be able to see the name panels in the main hall. They'll be visible once again. It's a major development, this is. The scaffolding surrounding the gate will remain in place until the end of the works, which are on schedule to be completed next year, and therefore the names on the other parts of the memorial, the outside of the gate itself, we still won't be able to see them. They'll be inaccessible. People remember up on the ramparts there was a Menin Gates Moments exhibition, an art exhibition, and that's going to remain in place. So just to summarise the work that has been completed, the name panels have been restored and repaired where necessary. There's 1,200 panels, and only two of them have actually been replaced. The rest have been repaired. The vault and the ceilings have been completely restored and repainted. The round openings in the ceilings have been protected with a new treatment, and they put new cable in for lighting, and a sound system has been installed. The steps in the stair towers were completely removed. They were then repaired and then replaced. And where necessary, stone repairs have been carried out on the lion on the roof of the memorial. And a temporary roof was recently installed to allow work to the roof to be carried out. So what's going to happen next in the second stage over the next 12 months? Well, work on the monument continues with replacement of the damaged bricks and repointing of the entire memorial. The repairs and repainting of the north and south galleries. There'll be internal concrete repairs, the application of a new waterproof layer on the roof that was talked about in the video, the installation of that eco roof, and the installation of new lighting and suitable pigeon protection. It's been attacked by pigeons, as all buildings are. And if you want to find out more information about this, and if you go to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website, and look under our work, Menin Gate Memorial Restoration, you'll find a lot more information than I've been able to give you today. So that's real progress and something to look forward to when we return to Ypres. So that's it for this week. Not sure what's coming along next week. I'm off to the battlefields again, guiding a group of Royal British Legion members. No doubt we'll be doing some recording out there. And thank you very much for tuning in once again. And it's been great to receive contact from so many people recently in emails or messages on social media. Please do continue to rate, review, and really does give me and the podcast a great lift. So until next week, we remember Percy Rowe from Collingwood Football Club, and all his Australian mates that died alongside him, like Tom Wright, a few days later. We remember those, as usual, by the playing of the last post.